Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling two, well, really iconic American short stories. We've got James Baldwin's Sonny's Blues, that's from 58.
And Toni Morrison's Recitative.
Right. And our mission here isn't just to, you know, recap the plots. We want to dig into how these texts show people coping with some heavy stuff. Societal pressure, personal trauma, family history.
Yeah, and they offer really different ways of looking at it. Baldwin, he gives us this intense portrayal of suffering in 1950s Harlem, but also how art, specifically jazz, can maybe articulate that pain, even redeem it.
Okay.
But then Morrison flips it. She explores what happens when memory itself is the battleground. Two people share a past, but their stories about what actually happened fundamentally clash. It's about articulation versus argument, really.
Okay, let's dive into Baldwin first then, Sonny's Blues. Give us a bit of context on Baldwin himself.
Sure. James Baldwin. Major voice. Grew up in Harlem, deeply affected by the racism and homophobia he experienced. Became this towering figure in American literature, think Go Tell It on the Mountain. He was seen as, you know, perhaps the most important black writer since Richard Wright at the time.
And Sonny's Blues feels incredibly personal. It kicks off with the narrator, he's an algebra teacher, reading about his own brother, Sonny, in the newspaper.
Yeah, arrested for heroin, peddling and using. And the way Baldwin describes the narrator's reaction is just visceral. It's not just shock, it's physical. He feels this great block of ice forming in his gut.
And melting.
Yeah.
Slowly. That image of ice water in his veins, it's dread, isn't it? Pure, cold dread.
Exactly. And it's not just about Sonny's individual choices. The narrator connects it to the whole environment, to his students. He looks at these kids in Harlem, and he sees the same pattern.
He describes them as having this sort of energy, this rush, but then their heads just bang. They hit the low ceiling of their actual possibilities. That phrase is haunting.
It really is. It captures that feeling of being trapped, hemmed in. And he talks about the darkness they live in. Two kinds.
Right. The darkness of their lives, the real systemic stuff, and then the
darkness of the movies.
Which, he says, had blinded them to that other darkness.
Wow. So the movies, popular culture, it's presented as this kind of dangerous distraction. Like, it stops them from seeing the real trap they're in.
That seems to be the implication. A sort of manufactured escape that obscures the reality of their limited options in that specific time and place. It's a pretty sharp critique.
And the narrator, he's kind of tried to escape that darkness himself through respectability, through his teaching job. But he can't escape the family history.
No, and that's where the mother's story comes in. Before she died, she tells him something crucial about their father's brother, their uncle.
Oh, yeah. The story is brutal. Killed years ago.
Hit by a car full of drunk white guys. Just ran him down while he was taking a leak behind a tree in the moonlight. It's horrifyingly casual. And the father apparently never got over it. He saw the car drive off and told the mother he'd never in his life seen anything as dark as that road. That silence, that unprocessed trauma.
It hangs over the family, and it leads directly to the mother's instruction, her mandate, to the narrator. The world ain't changed, she tells him. You gotta hold on to your brother.
So that block of ice isn't just about Sonny's arrest now. It's generational. It connects directly back to that dark road, that unspoken horror. Sonny's addiction isn't just a personal failing in this light.
Right. It's presented as perhaps a symptom of this larger inherited weight. But, you know, you raised a good point earlier. Does this excuse Sonny?
Yeah, that's the tricky part, isn't it? How do you show the systemic pressure without removing individual agency or responsibility?
Baldwin walks that line very carefully, I think. He shows Sonny isn't passive. His friend even says Sonny doesn't want to die, he wants to live. The heroine for Sonny is about managing the internal chaos, the storm inside.
He describes the feeling of heroin as giving him distance, control, warm and cool at the same time. It's an artificial peace. A way to cope when other ways fail.
An escape, just like his music is meant to be an escape, or maybe a channeling. He's desperate to be a jazz pianist, idolizes Charlie Parker. Burn?
And dismisses Louis Armstrong, calls him old-time, down-home crap. He needs something modern, something that speaks to his experience.
Absolutely. And his commitment to the music is almost frightening. Remember when he's staying at his brother's house, practicing constantly? The family is terrified by the intensity.
Yeah, the narrator says it sounded like he was playing for his life.
Which, in a way, he was. And that leads us to the climax, right? The scene in the jazz club in Greenwich Village.
Yes. Creole, the band leader, he sort of guides him, holds the band back, lets Sonny find his footing, waiting for him to strike out for the deep water.
And when Sonny finally does, when he starts playing the blues,
It's transformative. The music suddenly holds everything, not just Sonny's pain, but the whole family's story.
You feel the weight of the father's trauma, the uncle's death, the mother's worry, even the narrator's own loss, his daughter Grace. It all flows into the music.
And then that final image, the drink on the piano, the scotch and milk. Baldwin describes it shaking above Sonny's head like the very cup of trembling.
The cup of trembling. That's biblical, isn't it? From Isaiah.
It is. It signifies immense suffering, divine judgment, something that must be drunk, endured. By using that image, Baldwin elevates Sonny's blues beyond just personal struggle. It becomes this profound artistic expression of historical and existential weight.
So the music becomes the language for this unspeakable suffering. It allows for connection, for understanding, maybe even for a kind of catharsis.
That's the hope Baldwin offers, I think. Finding a way to make the storm listenable, to share the burden through art. It's a powerful model.
It really is.
Yeah.
But then we turn to Toni Morrison, and Recitative seems to pull the rug right out from under that idea of shared understanding.
It does, dramatically so. If Baldwin shows suffering being articulated and potentially shared, Morrison plunges us into a situation where the shared past itself is fractured, contested. The ambiguity is the point.
And it starts immediately with the setup, Twyla and Roberta. They're kids together at St. Bonnie's, a shelter. We know they're different races, salt and pepper, but Morrison deliberately never tells us who is black and who is white.
Which is just brilliant. It forces you, the reader, to constantly question your own assumptions as you read. They're 8 years old, dumped there, bonded because they're not orphans, and they're failing the same classes.
Despite, you know, the prejudices they might have initially absorbed, Twyla mentions her mother, Mary, warning her about them.
They never washed their hair and they smelled funny, yet the girls share a room, room 406, switch beds every night. They're united by their shared vulnerability, especially their fear of the older big girls upstairs.
Those older girls sound terrifying. Put out girls, runaways.
Yeah, 16, 17, a different level of experience. But the real dividing line seems drawn not by the girls themselves initially, but by their mothers.
Oh, that scene during the chapel visit.
Yeah.
It's so awkward and revealing. Twyla's mom, Mary, shows up looking, well, kind of flashy but inappropriate. Ugly green slacks, a ratty fur jacket. She wants to be friendly. Almost.
Almost. But Roberta's mother is the complete opposite. Huge woman, clutching this enormous cross and Bible, completely rejects Mary's attempt to shake hands, just stares past her.
And Mary's reaction just explodes, calls her that bitch right there in the chapel doorway.
It lays bare the social chasm, the unspoken racial codes of the time, embodied by the mothers. Even a simple handshake is impossible. But Twyla and Roberta, they navigate this, they maintain their bond. At least for a while.
Until they meet again years later. And their situations are completely different. The first time is at Howard Johnson's.
Right. Twyla's working there as a waitress. Blue and white uniform, the whole thing. And Roberta walks in, totally transformed. Halter top, shorts, off to see Jimi Hendrix with these two guys.
And Twyla doesn't even know who Hendrix is. It's this moment of complete disconnect. Roberta barely acknowledges her, almost seems embarrassed. The power dynamic has totally shifted.
And then it shifts again. Years later, another encounter, this time at a fancy grocery store, a food emporium.
Now, Twyla's the one living a more stable, maybe middle-class life, married to a fireman, James, and Roberta pulls up in a limousine.
Yeah, limo, driver, dressed to the nines, married to a wealthy executive, Kenneth Norton, living in Annandale. The economic roles are reversed again. Morrison keeps shuffling the deck, showing how class and status change everything.
But underneath all these changes, all these shifting identities, there's this one constant point of friction, the memory of Maggie.
Maggie, the kitchen worker at St. Bonnie's, mute, older, with legs like parentheses, a really vulnerable figure, and something happened to her in the orchard.
This is where their stories just completely diverge, isn't it?
Yeah.
Twyla remembers Maggie falling down. She remembers the big girls laughing, and she feels guilty because she joined in calling Maggie names dummy, bowlegs. But she insists Maggie just fell.
But Roberta remembers it totally differently. She's adamant. They knocked her down, she says. Those girls pushed her down and tore her clothes. She insists it was violent, an assault.
And Twyla just blank. She says she doesn't remember that at all. Roberta accuses her of blocking it out.
And that's the core of it. This potential act of violence against a helpless person, witnessed by both of them, becomes this unresolvable point of contention. Did Maggie fall, or was she pushed? Was it an accident or an assault? Their memories are mutually exclusive.
It's incredibly disturbing because it suggests that memory, especially around trauma, isn't reliable. It can be shaped or blocked or maybe even constructed differently depending on,
yes.
well, depending on what. Mm-hmm. Morrison doesn't give us an easy answer.
No, she doesn't. And that's the power of it. It leaves you hanging.
Yeah.
So if we bring Baldwin and Morrison back together, the contrast is pretty stark.
Yeah. Baldwin gives us a path, however difficult, toward articulating shared suffering through art, through the blues, finding a common language.
Whereas Morrison shows us a breakdown. The shared experience, the trauma involving Maggie, doesn't lead to connection, but to conflict. The darkness in Recitatif isn't just historical context, it's the fog of contested memory itself.
So, in Sonny's blues, the goal is to make the internal storm listenable, right? To find a way to share it. But in Recitatif, they're stuck arguing about what the storm even was. They can't agree on the basic facts of the trauma.
Precisely. Both stories are telling us something vital about dealing with the past, about survival. You have to grapple not just with the facts, but with how those facts are remembered or suppressed or expressed when words fail, like Sonny's jazz.
Okay, so wrapping this up, what's the final takeaway for our listeners? We've seen Baldwin's model of expressing historical pain through art and Morrison's challenge to the very idea of a stable, shared memory of trauma.
Well, Baldwin's narrator learns that understanding comes from recognizing and, in a sense, bearing witness to the suffering of others, like Sonny's. The music makes that possible.
But Morrison leaves us in a much more unsettling place, doesn't she?
She does. If Twyla and Roberta can't agree on something as fundamental as whether Maggie fell or was pushed down, if that core event is lost to conflicting memory, it makes you wonder how much of our collective history, our social understanding, is built on similarly shaky ground, on memories that might be selective or contested or just wrong.
So the final thought maybe is to turn that question inward.
Exactly. What essential truth about suffering, maybe something you witnessed or inherited, have you perhaps blocked or remembered in a way that avoids the hardest parts? And following Baldwin and Morrison, what kind of expression or what kind of confrontation with conflicting memory might be necessary to actually face it? To make that truth listenable, even if only to yourself.